Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all for being here. I'm Crosby Kemper, the director of the Kansas City Public Library, and it's great to have you here to listen to Cady Marton on her latest book, Enemies of the People. Cady Marton has had a great career, and we're very happy about having Hungarian Americans here. We have our annual Hungarian American Festival. We had Michael Korda, the great publisher and now author of many books, including not unlike Enemies of the People, a book about his family and how they got to, in his case, England first, and then America. And we've had John Lucas, the great Hungarian-American historian. Cady tells me that John and she exchange encomia on the publication of their books, which is only appropriate. Hungarian-Americans, and it's, of course, the thesis of her last book, The Great Escape, have populated America and England with genius. There are very, very few nice things that we can say about Stalin and Hitler. Let's face it, there are not many things. But the one thing we can say for sure is that they helped America and England to some of the intellectually, morally, literary, and scientific superstars of the world. Our culture has been enormously enriched by them, and perhaps especially by Cady Marton, who many of you will know from her bouts on TV with ABC News and NPR. You'll know her from her books, her book on George Polk, after whom one of the great awards in journalism is named. Her book on Raoul Wallenberg, one of the great heroes of World War II, and one of the few bright spots in the Holocaust. What you may not know is that she also herself has a great humanitarian career. She's the former chair of the International Women's Health Coalition. She's been the chief advocate for the Office of the Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflict at the United Nations. She's won a number of human rights and women's awards for her work in those causes over the years. So she's not only a great analyst of what goes on in the world, and of course is married to one of the great actors in the contemporary affairs of the world, Richard Holbrooke. So she lives that every day, but she's also herself been a great hero in the affairs of the world with regard to women's rights and the rights of children. So it's a particular pleasure for the Kansas City Public Library to have Cady Marton here with her new book, Enemies of the People. Please welcome her.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. I had no idea. I've done so many things in my life. I was standing there feeling older and older. So I'm just so happy to be here this evening among so many friends and to be in Kansas City, a city that has the wisdom to turn a bank into a library. That is my kind of town. It's a hard slog out there for those of us who insist that writing is still a worthy profession. But I promise you that I will continue writing, if for no other reason than hopefully Mike and Crosby will keep inviting me to return to this wonderful city that to me always speaks of Harry and Bess Truman. I feel their spirit. I wrote this book, Enemies of the People, my seventh book, because I didn't have enough history. My parents, Hungarian journalists, who survived the two great cataclysmic events of the 20th century, fascism and communism, came to America because they had too much history. They didn't want their children to ever look back on what they had left behind. They had suffered a great deal. They were survivors. of these two terrible events. But they made the mistake, I believe, of closing off whole chapters of our past. And when they, both of them, passed away, very sadly, 3 and 4 years ago, I decided to do something that I would never have done in their lifetime. That is to apply for the secret police, the Hungarian secret police file on my family. I knew that there would be such a file because my parents were, that's okay, that's usually my phone, don't worry. My parents were the last independent journalists left behind the Iron Curtain, the last to keep the West, the free world as it was then known, informed about the terrible brutalities of Stalinism and post-Stalinism. They were it. My father was the Associated Press correspondent. My mother was the United Press correspondent. As Hungarians, at a time when most Hungarians would cross the street to avoid having to greet an American, because America was the new enemy and Americans were the imperialists, they were suspect. My parents were working for the Americans. One of the great mysteries of my childhood, unanswered until just now, was why did they sign up with the new enemy, having just survived the Nazi occupation of Hungary? So why did they do that, especially as the parents of these two adorable little girls? That's me in the middle, the really cute one. And there are lots of pictures inside. Well, the files revealed a great many things. I was warned by historians that I was opening a Pandora's box by filing. You know of all the cases where, from Günter Grass to Milan Kundera, other writers who have accessed their files only to discover histories of terrible betrayal and treachery. Well, they were right. I did open a Pandora's box. I did discover unbelievable cases of betrayal from inside our family circle. Pretty much everybody who came in contact with the Martons was informing on them. The worst traitor of all was our babysitter. Can you imagine? She was a French woman who was only a part-time babysitter but a full-time communist agent. Using my sister and me, I was six, my sister eight, when our parents were arrested, using my sister and me as her primary sources. So there were other many other shocking things. But I suppose the most shocking discovery of all was that it was an American who ultimately led to my parents' arrest and trial and conviction as CIA agents. Let me at the outset assure you that my parents were not CIA agents. They were good reporters at a time when to report the truth was tantamount to being a spy. We see that happening today in many places, such as Iran, and I'm very much involved with press freedom issues. I used to head the Committee to Protect Journalists, and in fact, I'm just back from Moscow, where I did a mission on behalf of journalists who are not only being imprisoned, but murdered with impunity. So you don't have to look far to see why I am as concerned about journalists and about their families, because when my parents were arrested, as I said, I was 6 years old, there was no committee to protect journalists, and there was no one really left to look after my sister and me. I want to read you, I don't normally read from my books, because I think it's, I prefer to talk to people, but this book is the first book that I've written in the first person. And it is really the most personal and thus the most painful to have written. I had to open a vein to write this one, and I had to return to my child's self, my child's voice, to write this book, which I want to say to you at the outset is, yes, it's a deeply personal book, so much so that my parents wouldn't have liked it, because needless to say, the files revealed a great many personal things about them, including their infidelities, my father's recklessness. But I will tell you this, though my parents emerge as vastly more complicated characters than I ever knew, I say somewhere in the book that children never fully know their parents. Now, thanks to the secret police of Hungary, the dreaded AVO, the Hungarian Stasi, I do know my parents. I know more about them than most probably I should, but I come away feeling much closer to them than I ever did in their lifetimes. They're much more human to me. They're very real, incredibly crazy brave people, almost recklessly so. They took chances that I, as a parent, would never take. But they served a cause that they truly believed in. They were not impartial reporters. They really believed that in the Cold War there was a right side, and that side was the United States. And for that, they went to prison and suffered terrible torment in prison. In my father's case, Abu Ghraib-style interrogation. Hours of having to stand while obscenities were shouted at him and a confession ultimately extracted from him. But as with Abu Ghraib, the confession that they got from my father was fictional. And here's the lesson of that. If you beat up on a guy long enough, he'll tell you what you want to hear, but it's unrelated to the truth and thus not an effective tool for getting at the facts. My father, however, in all those days of this kind of brutal treatment, and he was in prison for almost 2 years. Imagine, as a six-year-old, I did not see my father for almost 2 years. When I think about that, and when I talk to I have two children, when we talk about that together, it seems like, how could that be? How could a huge segment of the world live under such a system? And millions of people, we are not, yes, it's a personal story to me, but millions of people lived like this for a half a century. We celebrate now the 20th anniversary of the end of the Cold War, but I'm here to tell you that the Cold War is not an academic concept. It was real. We lived it. It should never happen again. And I am happy to be a survivor of it, thanks to my parents. But the most wonderful moment, as I was plowing through thousands of pages, literally, and I photographed the files, just so you can see the hard work that I've been doing for the past 2 years translating. This mind-numbing language of the secret police, where human beings are reduced to playthings, translating them. And when I came upon this one piece of paper which said that Martin and all the hours and days of interrogation never once implicated another Hungarian, that was like my eureka moment, and I took that piece of paper because I was so afraid I was going to lose it among the thousands, and I immediately rushed out to Kinko's and had it laminated, and it still stuck to the bulletin board in our kitchen because I was so proud that, unlike all those others who made their deals and who, including my parents' closest friends, who succumbed to fear, and fear I learned as a young child, Fear is a very powerful weapon to use against people. My father did not succumb to that, did not implicate anyone else. But that was the high point in my translation work. The low point was reading about my father's two attempts at committing suicide while in the hands of the secret police. And they weren't just sort of casual attempts. They were very systematic. He was collecting sleeping pills that were freely distributed to prisoners because it was in the interest of the regime to keep prisoners. They were sedated already in their morning coffee. I don't think my parents knew that they were, but the files reveal that. But anyway, my father just pretended to be swallowing those nightly pills and actually collected 60 of them when he calculated that he needed 100 to finish himself off. And it was his cellmate, who of course was also an informer, for 10 extra cigarettes a day he was writing very long reports on my father's every movement, every thought. But thanks to this vile cellmate, my father was unsuccessful in his attempt at committing suicide because he dropped a couple of pills on the floor. And so when my father went to use the toilet, the cellmate signaled for the guards to come and search the whole place. And they found this collection of 60 pills inside the lining of his coat pocket, but he tried again. Anyway, that was not an easy discovery for a child. But I want to read you two passages. One of them will give you a sense of how total the surveillance that we were under for 20 years. My parents, and thus their children, were under the watchful eyes of the Hungarian secret police. Their every letter steamed open, their every phone conversation tapped, their every movement in the city of Budapest tracked and followed, as you will hear. But here's the biggest shock of all. When we thought we were safe in Washington, D.C., We had escaped the year after my parents were freed from prison. They were freed, by the way, as a result of the Hungarian Revolution of 1956. Just some weeks prior to that, there was a political easing up to kind of calm the people down. And they both went back to their jobs as AP and UP unrepentant correspondents. They were responsible for about 99% of the coverage of the revolution. And the following year, they were about to be arrested again. And at this point, my father, for the first time, puts his family ahead of his profession. Thank God, or I wouldn't be standing here. And that's when we started planning our escape. So the shock was, and this came out of the files, was that the Hungarian secret police sent agents to Washington to try to recruit my parents. So for 10 years, while we were already, we thought, safe, we were actually surrounded by agents in suburban Washington, where I was growing up, Bethesda, Maryland. There were agents swarming around us, but not only Hungarian agents. J. Edgar Hoover also didn't trust my parents. So the final file that I tapped, I filed for my parents' FBI file under Freedom of Information Act. By the way, it took much longer to get at the communist files in Hungary than it did to get the FBI files. But I did ultimately get them just as I was finishing writing the book and hurriedly wrote this last chapter about my last discovery. It was that Hoover had his guys following my parents too. So this is going to be a great movie. Two sets of goons swarming around my parents as they made their rounds, thinking that in America, where we had been greeted as heroes, for the same reason that we were greeted as heroes, you know, because my parents were freshly released from communist prisons, Hoover didn't trust them. Because anybody who'd spent time in a communist prison obviously has drunk the Kool-Aid or, you know, made some kind of deal to get out. That was the flip side of the Cold War. You know, the two sides in some respects were mirror images of each other. Paranoia was deep on this side as well as on the other side. So, you know, there were times when I was happy, as I was doing this work, I was happy that my parents didn't know a lot of this, because they would have been, you know, they loved this country so much. They thought America was the greatest country in the world, and they were just so grateful that we were given this welcome. And I think they would have been shocked that it was an American, A, who provided the evidence, and I hope you'll read my book and you'll get the full story of that. Why did an American give evidence against my parents? He was assistant military attaché in the embassy in Budapest, the American embassy in Budapest, and he was being blackmailed by the secret police because, same old story, you've seen this movie, he was caught in bed with an agent. Photographs, he was a married guy with kids, and diplomats during the Cold War were trained that if that happens to you, you go straight to the ambassador and you will be given a safe passage out of the country so you can do no harm. This guy did not do that. He continued to provide the communists with evidence against the two people who were most in their gun sights, my mother and father, and it was he who was responsible for their jailing. My father knew that because once I found out this story and found this man's name, the man's name came back to me as a name that was whispered a certain way between my parents. And several still surviving diplomats from that era also knew and confirmed it for me and confirmed that this was heartbreaking for my father, that it was an American who had done that, but succumbed to human foibles. Okay, let me just read you. This is just a very typical sample of the kind of daily surveillance record. And this is we lived under for 20 years. This is August 27, 1954, 10:05 a.m., Martin in a gray and black striped suit, in parentheses. I remember that favorite seersucker suit of his. And his two little girls left their home and got into a car, license plate, blah, 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 drove to Alkotash Utsa, where we photographed him stepping out of the car. He then went into a stationery store with the little girls. Inside, he bought them school supplies. 10 minutes later, the little girls carrying their school supplies, Martin left the store. Martin drove to Zserbo, my favorite cafe in Budapest. After finding a table, ordered ice cream. The three consumed the above while chatting. 12:20 p.m., holding his children's hands, Martin walked back to his car. They drove to Vatsiut and entered a toy shop. 12:30, holding his daughter's hands, Martin left the shop. One of the little girls carried a package wrapped in pink paper. 1:20, Martin and his little girls drove to the Hotel Duna, where they occupied a table in the garden. We continued surveillance while they ate their lunch. I close this. So to the AVO, the secret police, I owe a long ago late summer day washed away by dramatic events to come. It is now restored to me. Indeed it is. There were moments when I was grateful to the secret police. For example, my first ski lesson is captured here. I thought about actually dedicating this book to them. And then I thought, maybe, you know, irony doesn't work so well in black and white as it does in person. But I do owe the AVO a certain odd favor. Let me read you a short passage which deals with my father's arrest. February 25th, 1955. The overhead light in the room I shared with my older sister snapped on. My mother, a ghostly figure, hovered over our beds. "Children," she whispered. I lifted my head for an instant before dropping back on my pillow. "You have to get up. They need to search your room." My mother's voice, urgent and weary, was about to break. "Now." I could just about see who they were, shadowy figures, five or six of them, forming a dark mass in the corner. "Get into our bed," my mother said. As we slowly awoke, one of the searchers moved in. Like a hunter stalking big game, he sank his knife into our beat-up, stuffed rocking horse. Straw spilled out of my oldest possession as my sister and I ran to the room next door and dove into our parents' bed. We were too dazed to ask where Papa was. Or did we know somehow? Elvitek, Hungarian for "they took him away," was a word I heard often as a child. I did not understand where people were taken to, just that they were gone and not much more was said. So now my father had been elvitek, taken away. Of the few hours left of that awful night, I don't recall much more. My sister and I must have slept through the rest of the search, but I have been told so often what happened from 2 a.m. until daylight that I feel as if I witnessed both my father's abduction and my mother's ordeal. Tales of how the AVO ripped apart our home looking for evidence against my parents were part of my childhood. But only now, thanks to the files, am I able to reconstruct the night that ended the idyllic part of my childhood. At 7:30, so this is from the files. At 7:30 p.m., my parents drove to the apartment building of the U.S. military attaché and his wife on the Pesh side of the Danube for dinner and a bridge match, their favorite game. It was after 2 a.m. when they left the Americans, got into their car and negotiated the silent, snow-blanketed streets of the city up to our hilltop home. Later, my mother told me they had been in a mellow mood, alone in that car that always gave them the illusion of freedom. They probably savored another triumph at the bridge table. The garage where we kept the car was half a block downhill from our building. After parking, my father carried a bucket of ashes to sprinkle on the icy pavement. Papa was coming around to help my mother out of the car when the dark, silent street suddenly came alive with shadowy figures. On each side of my father and behind him, dark-suited agents closed in on him. Two of them gripped his arms above the elbows and led him toward their own car. Dazed from this scene out of a bad dream, my father thrust the bucket of ashes at my mother, quote, "as though it were our most prized possession," she later said. "But aren't you even going to kiss me?" she cried. His arms no longer free, he leaned toward her and kissed her cheek. Then they shoved him in the back seat. With its headlights off and the engine sound muffled by the fresh snow, the AVO car rolled silently down Chabotsa. Okay, in its humanity, the regime gave my mother 3 months to figure out what to do with her children before they came for her. So this is 3 months later. In the late afternoon of June 23rd, our doorbell rang. Entirely absorbed in my long-awaited playdate with Zsuzsi Kalmar, the older girl next door, I waited for my mother to answer it. Zsuzsi and I were cutting up an old dress of my mother's, which we planned to turn into doll's clothes. It was not by chance that Zsuzsi had chosen that afternoon to visit me. We only learned much later that she had been enlisted to play a small part in my mother's arrest, keeping me occupied during its smooth execution. At the time, I was excited to have this serious older girl's company and reluctant to get up and answer the door. After the second ring, I did. Three men in workers' overalls peered down at me. "We came about the meter," one of them lied. "Your mother rung. Please get her." I had a feeling they weren't who they said they were. Even to a child's eyes, these men did not belong in those too clean overalls. But I was eager to return to Zsuzsi. Now I wonder, what did it feel like for those secret policemen to be masquerading for a child? Did they feel anything at all? Were they the fathers of little girls? "Mama," I called out. But by the time she emerged from behind her closed door, I had already returned to my room and to Zsuzsi. When, sometime later, the apartment seemed strangely quiet, I peered out. Mama, I called. Mama, no answer. The apartment was empty. I had never before been alone in a place that just months before housed three generations, my grandparents, my parents, and us children. I had never before noticed how the floorboards in the dark entry hall creaked. As I rushed from room to empty room, I was aware of my heart pumping for the first time in my life. My mother was gone. How could she have left without calling out my name, without kissing me? Crying and calling out, Mama, I ran down the three flights of stairs that led to the street. My sister was sitting on the curb, crying, her bicycle lying next to her. She had seen the men in overalls holding our mother above the elbows shove her into the back of a Mercedes. But the car had pulled away before my sister could get off her bike. So we sat there, the two of us, and waited. For the first time in our lives, there was no one to comfort us, and I really have no memory of what happened next. So those were the two arrests. I will tell you this, that what happened next, I actually was able to describe because I found the man, an American diplomat, who witnessed the two little girls sitting on the curb and who actually tried to get us into his car and make us move. But I, always the stubborn one, refused to move because that was, I had lost both my parents on that same corner, and I do remember this. I had decided that I wasn't leaving that corner until my parents were freed. And obviously, eventually, somebody did persuade me to do otherwise. You may be wondering what happened to us during the time that my parents were in prison. Well, my mother, in the 3 months that were given to her to make arrangements for us, had arranged for her oldest friend, who was a woman of means with no children, who lived on a beautiful in a beautiful villa, and who told my mother not to worry, she would be a mother to us. Well, my sister and I were led to this lady's house by the same aforementioned agents, and she opened the door about this much and saw the two of us looking up at her, and behind us the agents, and her voice, extremely shaky, said, "Where should I send packages for the girls?" And that was the extent of her commitment to her oldest friend. Packages to us. That is the power of fear. That is the power of a state that says, you look after those girls whose parents are enemies of the people, and your husband loses his job, or your daughter doesn't get to go to college, or how many of you have seen that wonderful German film, The Lives of Others? It's a great film. If you haven't seen it, Netflix. It won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film, and it really captures what I'm talking about here, the power of fear to control the lives of decent, otherwise decent, good people, and It is the totalitarian state's chief weapon, and I think I changed a lot in the process of researching and writing this book, and I became much less judgmental in so many ways, because you know the old thing about walk a mile in someone else's shoes before you make a big judgment about them. I have now met so many of these people, and I bear them no ill will, those who succumbed. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to meet the French nanny, because she did more than what was necessary. She really, if there is such a thing as evil, she was that. And it's kind of belated vindication for me because I never liked her. She always liked my sister more. And I kept trying to tell my parents, this is not a person who should be a nanny. She's always in a hurry. Well, now we know why she was in a hurry. Her actual job was not being a babysitter, but informing on us. But it's been a growth experience for me. I'm glad I didn't do this book when I was a much more judgmental, much younger person, because then I would have been full of outrage about my parents' own behavior in their marriage. But ultimately, let me tell you something. My parents' marriage, which was on the brink when they were arrested, was saved in prison. And my mother always used to say that prison saved our marriage, and I never understood what she meant. Well, indeed it did. In prison, they came together. They only saw each other during their trial. But then after they were tried and sentenced to long prison terms, cut short, cut from, in my father's case, 23 years to 13, after they were convicted, they were allowed to spend a Christmas Eve together in prison. They couldn't receive visitors, so we never saw them. But they saw each other one Christmas Eve, and I describe that scene, because my mother, thanks to me, to my eternal gratitude, and now I hope you will find it interesting also. My mother kept a journal, which really helped me write this book, and it describes that meeting with my father in prison where they really fall in love with each other again. And it's the most heartbreaking, wonderful scene in the book for me. So they came out of prison a much closer couple. It's odd, isn't it? So yet another thing I owe to this treacherous totalitarian state. But let me tell you my final dramatic moment, if I'm not keeping you too long. And then we'll go to your questions. And that is that I tracked down the man who was sent to recruit my parents in Washington to try to entrap them. How do you do that? How do you entrap somebody living in Washington? Well, this whole totalitarian system is built on the core of it is that if you follow them long enough, if you collect enough information, you'll find a vulnerability, and then you blackmail them, whether they're in Washington or Budapest. So this man had the cover of a journalist. He was a colleague of my father's, and I just last spring found him, met with him, and had my kind of Mike Wallace moment with him, and I was very satisfied that I had done, unmasked him. I'm very satisfied that I have achieved what I set out to achieve here, and that is to, in a way, bring my parents back, because I miss them. In a way, I want my kids to know who they were, their grandparents, who really they were very old by the time my kids got interested in them. And now they have read this book and they have a sense of their own history, their own heritage, which is a priceless gift to give one's children. And what is even more important is that I hope you will have a more vivid sense of what the Cold War, as it was lived, was like. So not the historian's Cold War, but a little girl's Cold War and her parents' Cold War. And yes, my parents would have found this book way too personal. They were incredibly private people, and I do respect that. And I wouldn't have written it in their lifetime. And if I would have discovered something terrible in those files, I'm not sure what I would have done, but I don't think I would have pursued the project. There were times when I would come back from Budapest, always with new files. Turns out this was one of their biggest files. And I would feel sometimes that I had turned into one of the watchers. And at that point, Richard, who Crosby has spoken of in such nice terms, who's in Pakistan tonight, poor guy, he needs our prayers. Richard would say, no, Kati, you have to do this. This is important work. You owe it to your children, and you owe it to people such as yourselves. Thank you very much.
Before Ms. Altman takes questions, I do want to point out that the book is for sale from Barnes & Noble outside, and I think you'll be willing to sign books afterwards.
Happily.
Great. And I do want to say that while she's facing your questions and Richard Holbrook, her husband, is facing Al-Qaeda, the Taliban in Pakistan, that you have, it's your duty to challenge the difficulty of facing a Kansas City Public Library audience. You compared tonight by telephone to the difficulty of facing.
Oh, wow. What am
also,
I in for?
And one last thing. I promised Kati I would do this, and I forgot to do it in my opening remarks, but you're going to hear right now for 1 second the review that will appear in the Sunday New York Times of this book. And Alan First, who's a wonderful writer himself, sort of the successor to Graham Greene and Eric Ambler, has written the review. Actually, he hasn't written it yet, but we know what he's going to say.
He has written it.
He said this is an absolutely absorbing book. All the magnetism and excitement of all the best fiction, of all the
spy fiction.
Spy fiction, and a treatise on human nature. And inspiring. Those were all words that you have heard here tonight before they are even written for Sunday.
But anyway, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, no, it's a, I have to say, immodestly, I get a full page, flat out rave in the New York Times on Sunday, which is, as you probably know, that's every author's highest dream. I've had, this book has been out for 1 week and it's had seven, I have to confess, rave reviews, but the New York Times is of course the peak. Yeah. Yes.
Given that this history and the scars are still pretty fresh,
yeah.
Something in Hungary, has your book been published there, and how has it been received?
It is being translated now. It will come out in the spring. Somewhat, the Hungarians are now, I'm happy to say, translating all my books one after the other. So every spring there's a kind of a Kati festival. So I go over there and promote.
How would you anticipate the reaction to anything
else? You know what? I refer to the guy I tracked down, who is a very famous journalist in Hungary. I mean, really famous. He had his own show for like 30 years, and I refer to him by his code name, which is Flower, and everybody will figure out who it is. I have no interest in unmasking a very old man. In fact, I had I describe what it was like to confront a very old man. It was tough, and I really got weak-kneed when I saw him, because he seemed so old and kind of reminded me of my father at the end. But you know what? He gave me steel to proceed, because he was so cold and he was so absolutely unwilling to take any responsibility. He just flat out denied that he'd done anything but be a journalist. And I, at that point I said, I'm really sorry, but I have the files. And he said, well, where are these files? And stupidly, I didn't have the files with me. So I said, can you just wait here for 1 minute? And gambling that I was faster than he was, we were meeting in the cafe in my hotel. Like a bat out of hell, I ran to the elevator, ran upstairs, scooped up all my files, and out of breath, he was still there. And I said, well, here it is. And the files didn't have his name. They just had Flower on. And he saw, and he didn't say, who's Flower? That's not me. He just, then he got into version number 2, then version number 3. I didn't do them any harm. What's so harmful about this? And I said to him, well, you know how the system works. Every little piece, every shard makes up the mosaic. And when you said that my mother complained that we had financial difficulties, you were telling the secret police that we have, anyway, so we went round and round. And then I said to myself, you know, my parents would not think this guy was worthy of outrage. You know, this guy was really just a very small, weak cog. And so I said, thank you very much, goodbye. And I had my story. But ironically, this man's son is the consul general in New York. And whom I just saw last week at a cultural event. And I have a feeling he knows that what's coming. Because he didn't come over and give me the usual big hug. He was a little sheepish. So it'll be interesting. Yes.
How much of the files in Hungary were censored, and how much of the files that you got in relation to the American government surveillance of you was removed?
The Hungarian files are all available now and not censored. That was part of the, with the end of the Cold War, it's prescribed by Hungarian law, post-communist law, that any citizen can file, if you're willing to fill out 100 forms and wait, you have the right to file for your family file. That is legally mandated in Hungary as it is in East Germany. Not sure about the others. So I had, as I said, thousands of pages of document and hundreds of files, and I will never forget sitting in the archivist's office, these clerks wearing white coats wheeling in like shopping carts full of files, and I thought, oh my God, what is in these files? So I'm quite confident that I have all the Hungarian files. It's not in their interest to withhold anything at this point. The FBI files are somewhat redacted, somewhat edited out. I had some help getting at the diplomatic files because that was taking a long time, but I know a few diplomats. So actually it was John Negroponte who helped me because this was during the Bush administration, Richard's former roommate from Saigon days. So he helped cut through the thicket. So I learned some interesting stuff. Dulles, John Foster Dulles, was very involved in this case. And one of the great heroes of this book is the American ambassador in Budapest, who was terrific and who visited, no Hungarians visited my sister and me when we were finally placed in a home on the outskirts of the city because they were too afraid. But the ambassador, driving his huge Buick with the stars and stripes flapping on the front fender, came periodically bearing unheard of goodies like oranges and cute clothes. And anyway, he was a good guy. I wish he were still alive. Yes, sir.
Could you comment on your parents' reporting and your own experiences during the Hungarian Revolution?
Yes, that's an important chapter in the book. My parents' reporting was really astonishingly brave and quite complete. And they did win. The reason we ended up in this country was they won almost every journalism prize the following year for their coverage, including the George Polk Awards. First time ever that a couple, probably the last time too, that a couple has ever won that. The only one they didn't win is the Pulitzer because that has to go to an American national. But you'll see in the book the reporting is pretty complete. And we were given... during when the Russians came back in, massively with big tanks and so on, we were given sanctuary. The only Hungarian family to be given sanctuary at the American embassy. So we lived there for a while during when the Russians first moved in and were going sort of house to house. At that point, my parents would no doubt have been arrested. And we came out, then we went into hiding again, and slowly, slowly, it dawned on my father that maybe it's a good time to leave now. Yes?
How and why did your parents become the focus of attention, the communists?
I'll tell you why. They were a massive thorn in the side of the regime. They were the only free media. And at a time when the press was meant only to parrot the government's line, and there was no bad news coming out from behind the Iron Curtain, they were telling the truth.
So they didn't honestly believe that they were CIA. They were just trying to shut them up.
Well, from the communist perspective, my parents were the enemy. I mean, they weren't falling in line. My father once told me a funny story of sitting in a government's official prior to his arrest, and the office faced the Danube, and my father sees somewhere in the distance a plume of smoke rising and turns to the official and says, "Where's the fire?" And the guy looks at him and says, "There's no fire." So the bad news was just not allowed. Not a cloud strayed over Hungary during those nightmare years. Yes, sir?
How did their reports get out? I mean, they just had a teletype and sent it out?
We had a teletype in our living room, but mostly they dictated on the telephone. I think I was telling Crosby earlier that the first English word I learned, and I thought it was a word, was "hold on." I was told, I mean, from about age 3 on, that if somebody calls with a foreign accent, say "hold on," and those calls were coming from New York, London, Vienna, from AP and UP bureaus. So they were dictating their stories. Well, ladies and gentlemen, yes.
Oh, I was fascinated by your reading of the excerpt.
Yes.
Excerpt,
yes.
This is not a memoir for sure, right? Because it's a research thing. How interestingly one can go back on one's past.
Yes, research.
The way it really was, not the way you think you remember.
Well, this is, you raise a very interesting point, and that is that this is both a memoir, and it's based partly on my memories. Memories are famously faulty, so I needed documentation and I needed to find all the people because I wanted this to have the ring, the authority of truth. And for that, I needed the State Department files, I needed the secret police files, and I needed interviews with the survivors. And you know what? I'm so happy that I did it when I did, because even this took me just 2 years. It's the least amount of time that I've ever spent on a book because the story was in me. Even since I started, many of these people have already passed away. So it's, we're losing that generation, my parents' generation. So it was very important for me to get to these people as witnesses to these days. Yes? My sister did not contribute, and I was worried to death about her reaction to this because she, after all, my older, in her mind, wiser sister, I was very worried what she would think. And she came and visited us last spring when I had just finished, and for 2 days she disappeared and was reading it, and I was really sweating bullets, thinking, "Oh my God, what is she?" And she came out of our guest room with tears streaming down her face and gave me a hug, and she said, "It's beautiful, thank you." So that actually was my most important review, even more important than the New York Times. Yes?
You said that if you had done the research, yes, and written earlier, you would have been filled with outrage.
Yes.
How did you move beyond that sense of feeling outrage?
Familiarity. First of all, I've lived a life, which in my 20s I had many opinions and certitudes, but not a lived life. And maybe that goes even for my 30s. I was kind of a late mature. So yes, a certain experience with human nature. And thus, with experience comes tolerance, because we want others to be tolerant of us as well. I don't want my kids to be totally judgmental of me either. And also getting to know my parents and their astonishing history made me, they really were very brave, and they really provided the Western world, the formerly free world, with a record of that period, which I think is very valuable to have. Other historians have used their words and probably not credited them, but and even during the Nazi period, I had no idea that my father was active in the anti-Nazi resistance, because he didn't talk about that. It was a very selective. They were so forward-looking. You know, they threw us into American schools without speaking English, and you know, we were told, we made this crossing for you. You know, go, make the best of it, because you'll never get a better shot. So I come away feeling really, really proud of them, and very lucky to have had such parents. And I didn't really feel that before. I would just wonder, how could they put their kids through this? And you know, how could they one of the most shocking things I discovered was that at one point my mother pleads with the wife of an American diplomat to smuggle us out in the back of her car. Thought, oh my God, how, you know, I could never do that apart from my kids. But that's how desperate they were. This is right when they sensed they were going to be arrested. So they were much braver than I realized, and went through, but were very human ultimately, as you'll see. Anyway, thank you so much for your attention.